We've already mentioned the very recent Kharizmian Empire of Turkestan, Persia, and North India. This empire extended eastward to Kashgar, and it must have seemed one of the most progressive and hopeful empires of the time. Genghis Khan, while still engaged in this war with the Qin Empire, sent envoys to Kharizmia. They were put to death, an almost incredible stupidity. The Kharizmian government, to use the political jargon of today, had decided not to recognize Genghis Khan, and took this spirited course with him. Thereupon, 1218, the great host of horsemen that Genghis Khan had consolidated and disciplined swept over the Pamirs and down into Turkestan. It was well armed, and probably it had some guns and gunpowder for siege work, for the Chinese were certainly using gunpowder at this time, and the Mongols learnt to use it from them. Kashgar, Kokand, Bukhara fell, and then Samarkand, the capital of the Kharizmian Empire. Thereafter, nothing held the Mongols in the Kharizmian territories. They swept westward to the Caspian, and southward as far as Lahore. To the north of the Caspian, a Mongol army encountered a Russian force from Kiev. There was a series of battles in which the Russian armies were finally defeated and the Grand Duke of Kiev taken prisoner. So it was the Mongols appeared on the northern shores of the Black Sea. A panic swept Constantinople, which set itself to reconstruct its fortifications. Meanwhile, other armies were engaged in the conquest of the Empire of the Hsia in China. This was annexed, and only the southern part of the Qin Empire remained unsubdued. In 1227, Genghis Khan died in the midst of a career of triumph. His empire reached already from the Pacific to the Dnieper, and it was an empire still vigorously expanding. Like all the empires founded by nomads, it was, to begin with, purely a military and administrative empire, a framework rather than a rule. It centered on the personality of the monarch, and its relations with the mass of the populations over which it ruled was simply one of taxation for the maintenance of the hoard. But Genghis Khan had called to his aid a very able and experienced administrator of the Qin Empire, who was learned in all the traditions and science of the Chinese. This statesman, Yelyu Shutsai, was able to carry on the affairs of the Mongols long after the death of Genghis Khan. And there can be no doubt that he's one of the great political heroes of history. He tempered the barbaric ferocity of his masters and saved innumerable cities and works of art from destruction. He collected archives and inscriptions, and when he was accused of corruption, his sole wealth was found to consist of documents and a few musical instruments. To him, perhaps quite as much as to Genghis, is the efficiency of the Mongol military machine to be ascribed. Under Genghis, we may note further, we find the completest religious toleration established across the entire breadth of Asia. At the death of Genghis, the capital of the new empire was still in the great barbaric town of Karakorum in Mongolia. There, an assembly of Mongol leaders elected Ogdai Khan, the son of Genghis, as his successor. The war against the vestiges of the Qin Empire was prosecuted until Qin was altogether subdued in 1234. The Chinese Empire to the south, under the Sung dynasty, helped the Mongols in this task, so destroying their own bulwark against the universal conquerors. The Mongol hosts then swept right across Asia to Russia in 1235, an amazing march. Kiev was destroyed in 1240, and nearly all Russia became tributary to the Mongols. Poland was ravaged, and a mixed army of Poles and Germans was annihilated at the Battle of Liegnitz in Lower Silesia in 1241. The Emperor Frederick II doesn't seem to have made any great efforts to stay the advancing tide. It's only recently, says Bury, in his notes to Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, that European history has begun to understand that the successes of the Mongol army which overran Poland and occupied Hungary in the spring of AD 1241 were won by consummate strategy and weren't due to a mere overwhelming superiority of numbers. But this fact hasn't yet become a matter of common knowledge. The vulgar opinion, which represents the Tatars as a wild horde, carrying all before them solely by their multitude, and galloping through Eastern Europe without a strategic plan, rushing at all obstacles and overcoming them by mere weight, still prevails. It was wonderful how punctually and effectually the arrangements of the commander were carried out in operations extending from the lower Vistula to Transylvania. Such a campaign was quite beyond the power of any European army of the time, and it was beyond the vision of any European commander. There was no general in Europe from Frederick II downward who wasn't a tyro in strategy compared to Subutai. It should also be noticed that the Mongols embarked upon the enterprise with full knowledge of the political situation of Hungary and the condition of Poland. They had taken care to inform themselves by a well-organized system of spies. On the other hand, the Hungarians and Christian powers, like childish barbarians, knew hardly anything about their enemies. But though the Mongols were victorious at Liegnitz, they didn't continue their drive westward. They were getting into woodlands and hilly country, which didn't suit their tactics, and so they turned southward and prepared to settle in Hungary, massacring or assimilating the kindred Magyar, even as these had previously massacred and assimilated the mixed Scythians and Avars and Huns before them. From the Hungarian plain, they would probably have made raids west and south, as the Hungarians had done in the 9th century, the Avars in the 7th and 8th, and the Huns in the 5th. But in Asia, the Mongols were fighting a stiff war of conquest against the Sung, and they were also raiding Persia and Asia Minor. Ugdai died suddenly, and in 1242 there was trouble about the succession, and recalled by this, the undefeated hosts of Mongols began to pour back across Hungary and Romania towards the east. To the great relief of Europe, the dynastic troubles at Karakorum lasted for some years, and this vast new empire showed signs of splitting up. Mangu Khan became the great Khan in 1251, and he nominated his brother Kublai Khan as Governor-General of China. Slowly but surely, the entire Sung Empire was subjugated, and as it was subjugated, the Eastern Mongols became more and more Chinese in their culture and methods. Tibet was invaded and devastated by Mangu, and Persia and Syria invaded in good earnest. Another brother of Mangu, Hulagu, was in command of this latter war. He turned his arms against the Caliphate and captured Baghdad, in which city he perpetrated a massacre of the entire population. Baghdad was still the religious capital of Islam, and the Mongols had become bitterly hostile to the Muslims. This hostility exacerbated the natural discord of nomad and townsmen. In 1259, Mangu died, and in 1260, for it took the best part of a year for the Mongol leaders to gather from the extremities of this vast empire, from Hungary and Syria, and Sindh and China, Kublai was elected Great Khan. He was already deeply interested in Chinese affairs. He made his capital Peking instead of Karakorum, and Persia, Syria, and Asia Minor became virtually independent under his brother Hulagu, while the hordes of Mongols in Russia and Asia next to Russia and various smaller Mongol groups in Turkestan became also practically separate. Kublai died in 1294, and with his death even the titular supremacy of the Great Khan disappeared.